I remember with great fondness a past interview which I did with an author by the name of S.C. Gwynn. He and I spoke about a really marvelous book of his called Empire of the Summer Moon, Quanah Parker and the Rise and Fall of the Comanches, the Most Powerful Indian Tribe in American History. When I saw that S.C. Gwynn had written something else that and that I had the opportunity to interview him, I was very, very excited. But then quite surprised to see what this newest book was titled. His newest book is called The Perfect Pass, American Genius and the Reinvention of Football. So a book nothing like that first book with which I first encountered Mr. Gwynn. This book, however, turns out to be quite interesting, every bit as interesting as that first book, especially if you are interested in the game of football and wonder how certain aspects of football have risen and fallen in prominence over the years, and in particular, the place of the forward pass, which once upon a time was all but unheard of in the playing of football. And now it is, in a sense, a staple of the game, but not always so. It turns out that one of the unsung heroes when it comes to the forward pass rising in prominence in football is a coach by the name of Hal Mumme. And this is a story about him and about the really difficult road that a lot of football coaches face, far more difficult than most of us ever realize. And it's also about what it means to be a visionary with a game as often tradition-bound as football can be. Once again, the name of this book is The Perfect Pass, American Genius and the Reinvention of Football, published by Scribner, and its author, S.C. Gwynn. S.C. Gwynn, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Well, it's great to be with you again.
I'm glad we can do this. Tell us a little bit about your own connection to the game of football and what that has to do with the writing of this book.
Well, I'm just a good old-fashioned fan. You know, I was my hero when I was a kid was Johnny Unitas and Baltimore Colts. And, you know, when I moved to Austin, Texas 20 years ago, I just totally got into the Big 12 conference. And, you know, I'm not one of these completely kind of crazy fans, you know, who flies into different cities to do the fantasy draft and things like that. But I'm pretty much just a fan. And the book came from I went out to do an article about a coach named Mike Leach for Texas Tech back in 2009, who had the hottest offense in America. His quarterbacks had led the NCAA 5 times out of 6 years or something, and nobody could stop this offense. And I just asked him where it came from, and he said, I got to tell you a story about this coach named Hal Mumme in a little tiny school called Iowa Wesleyan back in the 1980s. And that turned out to have actually transformed the game of football.
Hmm. And you say in the kind of the acknowledgement section of the book that as you learned about this coach that nobody had heard of named Hal Mumme, that one of the best things about his intriguing story was its very obscurity. I mean, here is this great story just waiting to be told by somebody like you.
True, and even today, you know, I mean, how many people really have heard of Hal Mumme? Inside the football world, coaches, commentators, former players, he is pretty well known. But to the average rank-and-file football fan, he's not. And, you know, if you go back to there he is at this school in Iowa in 1989, a school with 450 students, you know, possibly the worst football team in America when he takes it over. You know, absolutely, it's complete obscurity. And so when he and his assistant coach Mike Leach are driving around in the off season through the frozen wastes of the Midwest, looking, you know, going to see people and looking for the secret of the forward pass, I just thought that just sounds like a great story.
And I don't remember where it is in the book, but at one point you characterize Hal Mumme as a genius who irreverently destroyed and recreated the game of football. And that's a really interesting way to think about it, about somebody coming along and, in a sense, destroying the game, not permanently or irreparably, of course. But what is behind that choice of words?
So So if you look at this, it's the game of football, and okay, it's offense that we're talking about here. But in fact, it's the product of all sorts of systems and ways of thinking about things. And you can really think of how, I do anyway, in the same way that you might think of one of those innovators like Jobs and Wozniak, inventing the Apple computer, or Hewlett and Packard, or people tinkering and being innovative and ingenious with, and indeed what they then do, their creations then do create enormous disruptive damage to traditional systems. If you look at what Hal's offense has done to football today, I mean, you turn on the TV and you're going to see some quarterback throwing the ball 49 times a game for 500 yards and 5 touchdowns. That's his offense. That didn't exist when he started. So he wreaked havoc on defenses all over the country, and he did it by doing things that no one had done before.
Hmm. So describe to our listeners where the book begins. I think it's quite effective. The first chapter is called The Mad Pirate's Revenge, and right. It's kind of interesting the way in which you just sort of plunge us into the new reality of football before then, in a sense, kind of explaining where this reality came from. So describe the dramatic game that is at the heart of this chapter.
Okay, so the book starts with 1 minute and 23 seconds to go in November of 2008. And the game being played is Texas Tech, which is sixth ranked, and had never been ranked that high before, or not recently anyway, and against University of Texas, number one ranked team, the best quarterback in the country at that point, Colt McCoy. And what I then describe is this incredible air raid offense that, people were starting to get used to, but it had only seen for a few years. That has this ability to, throw the ball 50 or 60 times and put up ungodly numbers of points and yardage on everybody, and no one could stop it. Well, we see this in action in the last minute of the game. And the final, and it's a very famous pass if you live in Texas, the final pass of the game is from Graham Harrell to Michael Crabtree, a 30-yard pass, and tiptoes into the end zone for the victory. And what I try to set up, as you say, is I try to set up, here's what this thing looks like. And then we sort of, and indeed, this is now swept through all levels of American football, high school, college in particular, NFL more and more. So I just go back to its origins and say, where did this guy get this idea? How did he implement this system? What was the process actually of transformation? How do you do that?
Hmm. I think it's very intriguing, and I'm really glad that the second chapter of the book is here, titled A Job You Wouldn't Want. And you begin this chapter by saying, in the annals of the American workplace, there are few jobs as thankless, unforgiving, underpaid, overworked, lacking in security, destructive to marriages, and mercilessly competitive as coaching college football. Yes, there is the warm glow that comes from making an impact on the lives of impressionable young athletes, teaching them the virtues of courage, discipline, teamwork, etc. But for the dewy-eyed idealists and everyone else, the more immediate reality is this. And you go on to describe in really rather brutal detail all of the ways in which this kind of work can be really kind of soul-crushing. I'm so glad that's there because, it flies in the face of what we sometimes hear about, which is of big schools paying their football coaches gigantic sums of money that dwarf the money paid to, for instance, professors at that same university. But that is just one little sliver of the picture. And what you are describing, of course, is the unhappy reality for the vast majority of college football coaches out there. Tell us more about why you think that is such an important point to make in this book.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a tough sport. It's a tough job, and it's high school coaching is really, football coaching is a really tough job too, except it lacks this one thing, which is the 24/7, 365 need to recruit all the time. And high schools generally don't do that. They basically take whoever lives in their district into their games. But college coaches, the minute the game ends or the season ends, they're on a bus or a plane somewhere to go recruit, and sitting in the living rooms of countless players and guidance counselors and parents, and trying to convince people to come. It's a hard job. It's also thankless because, as we all know, when the head coach gets fired, what happens to the assistant coaches? They all get fired. And I found myself in this world of, you know, people who often had 12 jobs in 20 years or even more. And it was tough. People moved around a lot. And when you look at someone like Mike Leach, who's now head coach at Washington State, you look at the hardship of those early years when he made $3,000 a year and lived in these miserable, broken-down trailers. It is a very hard job to do. And so Hal, in my description of him, he's not only up against all of tradition of football, trying to build this offense that does mostly passes the ball in a world that only wants to run the ball, but he's also got to deal with just life as a coach, which involves he gets fired, he gets run out of town. It's a tough deal.
Hmm. Well, and for him, it is also a reality that involves a wife and young children. So it's not just that he is subjecting himself to this because he loves the game of football so much and so desperately wants to coach it, but in a sense, he is taking along his wife and kids on this very difficult journey.
They're on the ride, and one of the things you hear and I write about is that, when the typical thing happens, which is, Thanksgiving comes around and the team hasn't done well and the head coach gets fired. And then, of course, all the assistant coaches get the news that they've been fired too. And often what happens is, if somebody is able to find a new job somewhere, typically the rules are you show up the next day and your family just has to worry about dealing with the problem itself, or whenever anybody hires a coach, they don't really want to hear that the wife, has got to sell the house or relocate the kids from school. And I just heard this from a bunch of coaches' wives. It's a very interesting world of really, I must say, really dedicated people, super, super dedicated people who run this game.
We're speaking with S.C. Gwynn, talking about his book, The Perfect Pass. And before we talk a little more about what Hal Mumme managed to develop, we should touch on the brief history of the game of football that you spell out. And I think the main reason that this is here is for us to have a better sense of sort of the entrenched reality against which this revolutionary-minded coach named Hal Mumme was going to try to work his innovative ideas. In brief, at least, just sort of describe the way in which football had a certain character right from the start, which, yeah, in a sense, was very inhospitable to the notion of throwing the ball, and particularly in terms of long forward passes.
Yeah, it goes back to the early days of football. I mean, football started with this kind of bloody scrum in the middle of the field that was just unbelievably violent. And the forward pass was introduced in 1906 mainly as a way to save the game. So many people were dying, 18, 20, 30 people dying a year, 150 with serious life-threatening injuries. And so they introduced it. But the problem was that American football always wanted to regress back to that game. And to this day, it's still portions of it want to do that. So even though there were little explosions of offense, Pop Warner in the Carlisle Indian School, or maybe Notre Dame with Newt Rockne a few years, Sammy Baugh at TCU, Norm Van Brocklin in the NFL with the LA Rams, basically football always reverted back to a heavily ground-dominated game. It was a running game. Throwing was something you did on third down, And really, if you look at it, what it finally comes to in the mid-70s is what they called the dead ball era. In 1977, in the NFL, fewer points were scored than at any time since 1942. Fewer passes thrown since the 1950s. It was regressing again, and it was so bad that the NFL changed all the blocking rules to try to save the game again. But this is the era in which this new breed of people, Mouse Davis and the run and shoot, Bill Walsh and the West Coast offense, Hal Mumme, Lavelle Edwards and BYU, these really handful of people that I write about emerge from this kind of dead ball era with these hot new passing offenses.
Right. And I guess part of the point of your book is that some of these innovators are well known to football fans, but somebody like Hal Mumme is not. That is, in a sense, a chapter of this story that was largely untold until your book came along.
Yeah, and there's a lot that's untold in here. I mean, nobody's ever heard of Tiger Ellison. I mean, Tiger Ellison in the 1960s invented a type of offense at a high school in Ohio that uses a lot of the techniques that are the basis for all of the high-powered passing offenses now. And who's ever heard of Tiger Ellison? He had this crazy thing called the Lonesome Polecat. Nobody ever heard of. And yet the techniques, when I go through, you know, his offense was the run and shoot, which actually became very influential. But there's a lot of obscurity here. Very few people really know who Lavelle Edwards is. I mean, they might know his quarterbacks, Jim McMahon, Ty Detmer, Steve Young, but at BYU. But so much of this is rising out of obscurity. And even today, these guys are not household, you know, they're not like Vince Lombardi. Maybe they will be one day, but they're not now.
So in terms of what Hal Mumme came to understand about the game of football and sort of its unrealized potential, I find it really intriguing that it was not just one single moment and a lightning bolt from the sky and suddenly I understand this new way of playing the game of football. You choose to describe it in this particular chapter as a series of four different epiphanies. And yeah. And these are epiphanies that unfolded over the course of years,
right.
and in different places and in different circumstances. Is this the way he sees it, or is this the way it made sense to you to frame it?
I don't think he ever saw it in terms of the four, although that's what it is. I mean, these came out of interviews with Hal. In fact, that's what it is. So there were four. One of them was really great, by the way. One of them, this guy is just good as a football coach. So he's the age 29, youngest offensive coordinator in the NCAA Division I. He's at University of Texas at El Paso, which is sort of the French Foreign Legion of college football. Terrible team. One of the worst in the game. They were playing against Brigham Young, BYU, who was the defending national champion, that had this super hot passing offense under Lavelle Edwards. And Hal, I think they were favored by 36 points or something like that, BYU was. Hal, because Hal was at UTEP, who was in the same division, he got to study their film. So he studied and studied and studied, and he tried to copy it. No one told him anything. It was like somebody who found a radio on the ground. You know, you pick it up and try to figure out how it works. And during this game, he unleashes BYU's own passing, this is 1985, passing attack against them, and beats them in one of the greatest upsets in college football history. And the other shoe dropping there is that BYU is so stunned that this guy has done this to them with their plays that they didn't even teach him, that they invite him up, and for years he spends time at the BYU camps, and he learns their system, which becomes the basis of his system. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, that's what we talk about when we say these epiphanies. You know, that game was an epiphany, that he could do that to the nation's best football team.
Hmm. One thing that is a little difficult to understand about this story is how there could be various people along the way, like this coach out of Ohio, Glenn Tiger Ellison, who writes a book touting some of these revolutionary notions, a book that eventually Hal Mumme reads and is inspired by, but how these innovative thinkers would appear, and yet their innovations would not, in a sense, lead sort of inevitably to this innovation sort of sweeping over the game. And he's not the only one, of course. But so there are these sort of isolated pockets. But what is different about the story of Hal Mumme from some of those other earlier instances?
I think if I had to say, what, that's a really good question. Let's look at Sammy Baugh, Dutch Meyer, coach of TCU in the Texas Christian University in the 30s. He had this quarterback named Sammy Baugh, who was maybe the best player who ever lived. And they ran a full spread offense. He ran from a shotgun. They used short ball control passes the way Bill Walsh later did. I mean, it was so far ahead of its time. So you would have thought, man, everybody's going to. But the fact is, hardly anybody did it. And so what was different about Hal? So one of the things that people thought about that offense was, or most of these offenses, is they wouldn't be transferable. Not, you know, they wouldn't be transportable. That somebody like Baugh couldn't be duplicated, or, you know, a receiver couldn't be duplicated. What Hal did, and this was maybe the biggest part of the revolution, was he designed an offense that could be run at the high school level easily. It was dead simple. The simplicity of the thing is most of the genius. It was just dead. So now you can see all over Texas where all of air raid offenses, all summer 7-on-7 air raid camps, the whole state's being swept by it. It's because you can teach it, because it's transferable. You can run it at junior colleges and small colleges, and you can run it anywhere you want to. I think if a coach reads my book and takes anything from it, I would think he would take the simplicity. This guy designed a game that was really easy and simple for his players, and really complicated and hard for your players.
And it also sounds like a system in which you did not necessarily need a spectacularly gifted quarterback or spectacularly gifted receivers in order for it to be implemented. I mean, you don't have to wait for an Aaron Rodgers to come along.
Exactly, and that's right. I should have said that you do not need that. And what it does is it makes you know, if you look at that great book Moneyball, written a few years ago, what it was about this guy at Oakland who's got $19 million, and New York Yankees have $190 million, and the problem is, how does the little guy in Oakland beat them? That's the problem. And the solution is how he uses statistics. In this case, Hal has these little guys, and how can they beat the big, strong, fast guys? Well, they can beat it through this system, a system that will allow a small quarterback or a receiver that isn't lightning fast to compete. So when you do it right, it levels the playing field, and there's a bit of David Goliath in it, with David and Goliath, which is kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. So a closing question. As we follow the exploits of Hal Mumme, one of the things that we sort of grapple to understand is why he's not more famous than he is. Why, if he ended up being such a brilliant innovator, why, in a sense, at least in the more conventional sense of the words, has his coaching career not been more successful, leading from one triumph to another?
Really, you can see the answer to that question, I think, at Kentucky. So he lights up the world at Iowa Wesleyan at the small college level. Then he goes to Division II, Valdosta State in Georgia, lights up the world, sets all the national records in NCAA D2. He's rewarded with the head coaching job in the SEC at Kentucky, 1997. And he takes his offense, and he beats Alabama and LSU. People said you could not use these video game passing offenses to win in the SEC. Hal did. Now we're at the peak of his career. Unfortunately, what happens to him is he runs into a recruiting scandal at Kentucky. Not his fault. It was one of his coaches was out making cash payments to high school coaches and very bad things. It didn't prevent Hal from having to resign in the middle of it, even though he was 100% exonerated by the NCAA, but that was a year later. And I think you could say in a lot of ways his career took a turn at that point. That it maybe is the main reason why he isn't the coach of the Green Bay Packers right now, or something like that. There were some other problems later on, but Kentucky was really his glory and his undoing, unfortunately for him.
Right, and of course, we certainly get a sense through the pages of your book that the world of football, just in general, is not always particularly receptive to the ideas of a revolutionary thinker.
No, and it's also a really razor-edge job, as we were talking about earlier. I mean, ask, you know, Colin Kaepernick and Les Miles about that, about how quickly things change. You know, Colin Kaepernick at the 49ers he was the second coming last year. Les Miles, a few years ago, was the greatest football genius in the country. They're guys that, you know, they're headed south real fast. So it's a cruel profession, I think. in addition to being, as you say, very unfriendly to people with new ideas who think they're going to throw the ball.
Right. Well, in the meantime, we get to know very much both the man and his intriguing revolutionary ideas, Hal Mumme, in this book, The Perfect Pass, American Genius and the Reinvention of Football, published by Scribner and the author S.C. Gwynn. S.C. Gwynn, thank you so much for writing this great book and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. This has been fun.
Greg, it has been fun. Thank you for such a careful read. It's great to talk to you.